Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by Christopher Cotter and myself, David Robertson. This podcast is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com. For legal reasons, we've bleeped out the names of some individuals and departments from this interview. Also, there is some discussion of Santa Claus coming up, so in the unlikely event that there are children listening, they may prefer to leave the room. So we're joined today by Professor Donald Weave, who's the Professor of Divinity in the Faculty of Divinity at Trinity College at the University of Toronto. He's the author of a number of books, including The Irony of Theology and the Nature of Religious Thought, and The Politics of Religious Studies, The Continuing Conflict with Theology in the University. Today we're going to be talking about the relationship between religious studies and theology. So Professor Weave, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
A lot of our listeners, and certainly I encounter this an awful lot being within religious studies, people maybe assume that I'm doing theology or that theology and religious studies are the same thing. So although it might be quite basic, I was wondering if you could just talk about what is the difference between theology and religious studies.
Having written those two books, I should be able to say very clearly what it is. But I'm not sure that it's going to be possible. Theology is a religious exercise rather than a scientific one. So people who are theologians are in fact faith-based in their study. We use the word, the German word, Glaubenswissenschaft. To describe theology, because it talks about a faith-imbued intellectual activity. And as far as the scientific study of religion is concerned, one doesn't work from a faith basis, but from a scientific basis, whether it's empirical historical sciences or theoretical sciences. Now, the problem is that theology itself is a bit of a problem because it's a logos of God, that is a rational account of God. So Christian theologians particularly, but others as well, tried to give a scientific account of their faith position.
Okay.
And so it's a hybrid mode of thought, and it sometimes confuses people. So students of religion who are concerned with science use the word theology in a kind of iconic fashion simply to point to those who invoke their faith when they're studying religion.
Okay.
I hope that's clear.
Yes, indeed. So we're talking about the relationship between these two distinct disciplines. Why are we having to talk about that? Has there been a big historical relationship between the two? If you could comment on that.
Yeah, we do talk about it because the medieval university, the ancient university, was in fact a Christian institution.
Mm-hmm.
Theology is still ensconced. I mean, there are legal relationships between the church and the modern university, whether in Europe or in the UK, not so much in the US or Canada. Many religious studies departments emerged in association with those already existing theology departments. And I think it's the case that many of the theology faculties felt that religious studies would broaden their interests, still be faith-imbued study of religion, but a little broader than Christian theology. And as time went on, more and more people entered religious studies from a strictly scientific perspective, and that's when the conflict emerges. Who gets appointments, when your department grows? Is it theologians or scientists? And so that conflict is still going on, I think, in certainly Germany, in the UK, and in the USA.
Hmm. A lot of religious studies scholars are going to have a faith position. Is having a faith position, does that always lead to theology, or is it possible to maintain your own sort of distinct faith position whilst maybe studying your own faith from a scientific perspective?
That's a good question, I think it's possible to be religiously committed and be a good scientific student of religion. You have to keep the two separate. You don't allow... let me just back up a bit to say that when I went to the University of Lancaster to start with study with Ninian Smart, I was very much a devout evangelical Christian. I felt no conflict in terms of looking at religion from a scientific perspective. What I found happening is that from my scientific perspective, I began to see religion as being more problematic and my own faith position as problematic. But I had also relationships with colleagues who did not wind up with that kind of position and were still good historians or good philologists, good New Testament scholars, and kept their faith separate from their studies. On the other hand, institutionally, structurally, one still finds more religious people being hired rather than leaving religion out of the equation altogether.
And that's a brilliant point for me to say, why is that?
Well, at Lancaster, I found out that that there was actually a clergy person on the committee that was looking after religious studies, and that appointments really rested on the person having a relationship to the church. Now, that's one particular instance. In the U.S., the American Academy of Religion is dominated by scholars who are religious, but also scholars. Mm-hmm. And what they do, it's what I'd call the last chapter syndrome. You'll find a lot of people who are great scholars on one religious topic or another, and they write their books and provide you with a great deal of historical information or theoretical analysis. And the last chapter then applies it to, you know, religious themes and how this can help develop religion. And it's that confusion that we think is problematic. Mm. If you're going to provide an explanation of religion, it should still be theoretical and from a scientific and faith-distant perspective. I mean, you wouldn't expect invoking God in terms of explaining things in physics, chemistry, biology. And yet in these last chapters, you find God always reappearing as an explanatory kind of force. So that's the problem that we find. Mm. At least those of us who are fighting what we think is the science, religion, and the theology, religious studies conflict.
Okay. For the listener's benefit, I have been reading the paper that you're going to be presenting later in the week here in Budapest. So one question that arose from that is, does religious studies succeed in being this scientific, non-theological, non-faith-based approach to the study of religion, or has it failed? I suppose we'll put it rhetorically like that.
We think it has failed.
Okay.
If we look at it historically, we do not find more than a handful of departments that approach the study of religion, both in terms of data collection, understanding simply, you know, what's going on in the world of religion, but also in terms of trying to explain why religious people behave the way they do in their particular locations. We don't find that kind of theoretical account being given. Now, in terms of the modern approaches to the scientific study of religion through the cognitive sciences, we think that perhaps it is... we can account for the fact that this failure occurs because of the nature of the human mind. That is our evolutionary psychological development.
Okay.
We are hardwired, so to speak, to detect agency, and to make a very complicated story, you know, short and to the point. People will naturally think in terms of supernatural agents when there is something that they cannot explain. So the American Academy of Religion is a wonderful example of this. people automatically bring in their religious beliefs to explain religious behavior. And we think that's circular reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
But our minds are hardwired to invoke agency to explain agentic action. And so we just... Professor Luther Martin, I think that... we know that it's logically possible to study religion scientifically. That's not the issue. But the way our minds are wired, most people will not do the hard work and keep their agency thinking in abeyance and look for hard scientific accounts of religious behavior. So we do not think that institutionally departments of religious studies will in fact become scientific in their orientation, because religion is just too valuable to people in terms of their everyday life. That's kind of putting it in a nutshell.
My own personal area of research is into non-religion, and I'm always concerned that we don't get into portraying the religious. You know, it's the people who are religious that are the problem, kind of thing. Do you find the same sort of, we'll say, agenda coming through in the writing of scholars who are openly not religious when they're approaching religious studies?
In other words, are they as biased as the religious types?
Yes.
You certainly find those kinds of people.
Mm.
Richard Dawkins' book on the God delusion shows that kind of atheist bias absolutely clearly. Daniel Dennett in the UK, the US, I find him to be a pain and a pill because he does the same thing. So I find them as obnoxious, so to speak, as I do the religious types. I think that this is that they are anomalies.
Yeah.
Because what we're doing generally, that is the scientific types in the study of religion, are generally simply saying this: when you are going to explain religious behavior, do not invoke the gods. When you explain physics, you do not invoke the gods. When you explain chemistry or biology, you don't invoke the gods. When you explain religious phenomena, you should not invoke the gods. So religion must be held at arm's length distance from whatever faith position you hold, whether you're an atheist or a theist. But an atheist could look biased, right? But the atheist, the good atheist, is working on a methodological principle.
Hmm.
No invoking of supernatural agency. And that's equivalent to what physicists, chemists, biologists do. But if they get rambunctious about that methodological principle, then they could have their atheist bias keeping them from seeing what's actually going on.
Taking things back further, back to... I'm thinking of Wilfred Campbell Smith or Ninian Smart. You have this sort of idea that in the very definition of religion, there's a sort of transcendent focus. I think it was Campbell Smith that used the term focus. How does one account for the supernatural orientation of religious individuals and the supernatural element in religion without commenting on whether that is real or not?
I think Milford Spiro has a wonderful phrase that helps one see the difference, and that is that we can recognize in other cultures the cultural postulation of supernatural beings that we have no interest in believing in. I mean, they don't persuade us. Westerners find it hard to think in terms of nirvana or in terms of, you know, emptiness as being the ultimate metaphysical reality in Buddhism. So we talk as anthropologists or sociologists of the cultural postulation of a supernatural reality. It just means God talk, right? So we know that people are involved in God talk or nirvana talk, but that's just talk. The people who actually then say, my supernatural reality exists, and then draw that in their explanations, that's the problem.
Mm.
So Wilfred Smith and I had many, many arguments over the years. He simply could not see that he was, in his definition of religion, he didn't like the word religion. So he distinguished between faith and expression of the faith. But his faith element was connected to an encounter with God. So he had a metaphysical entity built in. And that, again, in the sciences, is unacceptable. You work with the data that you have, and the only data you have is God talk, nirvana talk. You don't have God. Professor Willard Oxtoby, with whom I worked at the University of Toronto, we also had a television debate about this kind of thing, and we talked about the social reality of Santa Claus. Mm. Children believe in Santa Claus, or St. Nicholas, Father Christmas, whatever we call the person. And we know that Santa Claus, the belief in Santa Claus, has an effect on children, even on some adults. But we don't postulate the existence of a Santa Claus. So we have Santa Claus talk, but no real Santa. And we have God talk, and we don't know whether there is a God or not, and therefore we don't invoke such a being in our explanatory accounts.
Wonderful. I don't know if we'll have any children listening, but should probably put a warning at the start. Okay. So I will want to talk about getting back sort of into the academy and the relationship going on there. But just now, this sort of... We're portraying a sort of a conflict of interest, I guess, between theologically minded scholars and more scientifically minded scholars of religion. And I'm wondering, does there always have to be that conflict, or have you been aware, or could you postulate a situation where those sort of two approaches are more harmonious?
Yeah, I can imagine them being harmonious because there are nice people in both camps.
Yeah.
I can imagine that harmony breaking down when we get a new funding for a new appointment. Who will we appoint? What kind of person? A scientific one, or one who is also theologically committed? There, things begin to break down. When we take a look at the overarching objectives of the Department of Religious Studies, what ought it to be? And in my own departments that I've worked in, one could never agree that we were looking for a scientific explanation for religious behavior. Why? Because many in the department felt that, the gods actually existed, or the Christian God actually existed. And so a scientific explanation would undermine such a belief. I myself was excluded from the Department of Philosophy in a cross appointment at the University of Toronto because the four professors of philosophy of religion there said, no, we couldn't take a chance on this because you might undermine the faith of students. And you see, it seems to me that that is not an issue for a university classroom or program. My good friend at the University of was fired. Now, he was in a department of, a faculty of divinity, but as part of the university, and he lost his post in that faculty because he wrote books about Jesus not rising from the dead, but rather rotting in the grave. It offended religious people. Was his explanation wrong? Not likely. On the other hand, did he lose his job in a modern research university, which he shouldn't have done? Yes, he did, and he shouldn't have done. So it is that kind of authoritarian protection of religious beliefs from certain kinds of explanations, and therefore certain kinds of appointments, that might shift the balance of power in terms of the kind of explanatory accounts that might be given. So I think that the conflict will be perpetual as long as theology is given any place in the university at all. So, I mean, is this naughty? No. I think there are churches, mosques, temples, etc., and this is where religion belongs, in those particular locations. Should it be in the modern research university? Only as an object of analysis.
So, where you study theology from the outside, you study the theology of others rather than doing the theology
exactly.
Itself.
Exactly.
So a lot of this comes down to funding, the funding that is provided for theological studies of religion and the funding or perhaps lack thereof that there is for non-agenda-based studies of religion. How do scientific scholars of religion convince funding bodies that what they're doing is worthy of investment?
We find it almost impossible to get that kind of funding. Again, let me take my university as an example. The dean of the School of Graduate Studies wished to hire for the department. Some of us were opposed because we said he's a theologian. He approaches his analyses of religious phenomena from a religious point of view, and we didn't want it. Why did that happen? Well, the dean of the School of Graduate Studies happened to have been a lapsed Catholic. I suspect that he liked the way pinched the nose of the Pope. And here was he could keep his own religiosity alive in the university by hiring to teach in the religious studies department. We find that happening all the time. Why does society not want to support the scientific study of religion? Because it may, in fact, undermine religion. If you actually do find a persuasive, non-religious account of why people behave religiously, it might undermine religion. If you might undermine religion, you might undermine social order. And so people do not wish to fund what looks like an anarchic activity. If you look for private funding, the people who have a great deal of money are usually very committed to religious enterprises. I think of the Templeton Foundation. Mm. They have a $1.2 billion endowment, and people who will phrase their projects consistent with their objectives of proving the existence of God and the value of religion to people, they get the money. We don't. This again is why the paper I will deliver later this week is a confession that I may have wasted my life in trying to establish a scientific study of religion, even in the modern Western research university. It seems to be a negative enterprise. It isn't. It's a positive enterprise in terms of explaining human behavior. But the people who have the money, whether in universities and government authorities, who are religiously oriented, theology will get the money, religious studies won't.
We're approaching the end of our interview, and maybe we can try to finish on a more positive note, because I don't want to be depressing our listener. Whilst religious studies up till now might have failed, we'll say failed, to adequately provide a scientific approach to the study of religion, do you see, I know from reading your paper that you perhaps see glimmers of hope.
You're right, I do.
If you could talk about those for a little bit before we finish.
Yes, I think two things that come to mind is that given the tension between religions, you know, a kind of Samuel Huntington thesis about the clash of civilizations, mm. I think this has spurred certain governments to spend money to do sociological study of religion, maybe psychological studies of religion that will help lawmakers think more reasonably about how to keep multicultural societies from tearing apart. So I see the European Union, you know, providing hundreds of thousands of euros for research in religion. This sounds exciting, and it has possibilities. The school in Aarhus, Denmark, is getting a great deal of government money to do the same thing. The younger scholars that I see coming up are now excited about new possible theoretical accounts of religion coming from the cognitive and the neurosciences. So I think there are possibilities of a new approach taking place because of the younger generation, the money that is flowing into it. My only hesitation here is that I don't yet see an overarching objective towards which all of this partial research projects are actually heading towards. But I think that kind of theoretical thinking is going to emerge as all this new scientific experimentation is going on. And so I have a glimmer of hope that the next generation will provide us with a genuine scientific study of religion. But I suspect it will take root only in two or three or four universities around the world.
We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. There's so much more we could have talked about.
Indeed.
Maybe we'll save it for another time. But
thank you very much.
And thank you, Professor Weep.
You've been listening to Chris talking to Professor Donald Weeb at the European Association for the Study of Religion conference in Budapest, September 2011. Don't forget to check out the response we'll be publishing to that podcast on our website on Friday. And come back next week when I'll be talking to the erudite and handsome Graham Harvey, who coincidentally happens to be president-elect of our sponsors, the BASR, about animism, both in its classical form, which posits that inanimate objects, trees, rivers, even natural phenomena can be imbued with spirits, as well as his own more radical take. If you want to let us know what you thought of the podcast or of the project in general, get involved at our website www.religiousstudiesproject.com, on Twitter at @projectrs, or on Facebook at the Religious Studies Project. And as always, thanks for listening.